solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
I didn't actually think about my HBS degree as like an asset that I could market. I just took it as a development opportunity, a learning opportunity. And now I realize years later how it does help, and it can be leveraged from both the institution and what it represents, and that what I'm most excited about now is being able to extend everything the school is potentially about and the learning to the social sector. Mm-hmm. And so over the years, I've started to feel very proud of the fact that you can have this kind of background, but you can kind of move out, for lack of a better word, and bridge to the social sector. And I think more and more people are starting to walk that bridge. And I think that bridge is not as shaky as it used to be, even in my time and in the years that, you know, I made the transition.
Hello and welcome to the 31st conversation at the Play to Potential podcast. This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I'm an executive coach, and I work with leaders and organizations during periods of high-stakes transition, whether it's a role transition, a leadership transition in a company, or a career transition for the leader concerned. For more, please visit transitioninsight.com. My guest this time is Neera Nandi, co-founder of Dasra, a strategic philanthropy foundation. Neera and her husband, Deval Sanghvi, started Dasra about 19 years back. And since its inception in 99, Dasra has been working on accelerating social change by driving collaborative action through powerful partnerships. And this includes partnerships with corporates, foundations, families, nonprofits, social businesses, government, and media. A quick note on how you can access the podcast. You can access it at playtopotential.com, or if you want to listen offline, you could download it on any of the popular podcast apps on the Apple and Android platforms. Without further ado, over to my conversation with Neera. Neera, thank you so much for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Thank you.
And congratulations on this wonderful office in this new location.
Good. Yeah, we're happy. We're all together finally in one place, all 120 of us now. So
lovely. And I know this is an audio conversation, so the listeners won't get a sense of the space, but really, really nicely done. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Neera, in my conversations, I like to rewind the clock a little bit to get a sense of where people come from. And one of the pieces I try and explore is formative years and how, let's say, the first 15, 18 years shape who we are, shape a big portion of who we are. So if you went back in time, are there two, three things that stand out, which still forms a core part of who you are?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, first 10, 15 years of life, I was 10 years old when my parents sent me to boarding school to India. So I was born and raised in Canada. Mm-hmm. And my parents immigrated. Both of them went to IIT Kharagpur. And my mom was the first woman electrical engineer from IIT Kharagpur. So they all went with the brain drain to Canada. And so we sort of grew up there like a regular Indian family. And at the age of 10, my parents sent me to boarding school with this whole understanding that I would learn about my country and my culture and be more of a balanced person, is what they told me. In retrospect, now that I have kids around the same age, I realize, oh, it's so great just to send kids off to boarding school because you can learn and be disciplined, and you know, it's easier for parents in some ways. But
which,
I think that...
Which one was it, if I may ask?
It was in Bangalore. Called Bishop Cotton Girls' School. And my mom really just chose it because the weather was nice in Bangalore.
fair enough.
But I think that really shaped me in a number of different ways. I think when you're 10 and you're sent off to school, there's an element of like being independent, but you start to form relationships and you start to realize how important who you're with influences you. And at school, I was very privileged to the extent I was one of the few folks who came all the way from Canada. And so I couldn't go home that often. And so my matron there would always kind of make me feel very special. And I felt very spoiled. And at times, I think I took advantage of my position because I'd bring like bubble gum and stuff, tuck, and I would trade my gum for like chana or banana chips, and it was never sort of fair amounts. But yeah, I think that experience really, really shaped me in terms of being more comfortable with myself, with where I am coming from. And I think also just a sense of discipline and routine. And I think what boarding schools end up shaping people, you don't realize at the time, but in retrospect, I think that was probably one of the important moments, I suppose, in my life. If we're still on the 10, 15 years. So I almost for most of those years went to an all-girls school. So Bishop Cotton was an all-girls school. Then when I came back to Canada, I went to an all-girls school. And I think it helped me. I mean, I complained all the time, but it helped me because, and now that I even look at research for single-sex education for girls, I think you start, one, girls start to opt out in the co-ed format from math and science. And I think, I didn't actually have an option. So my parents were like, you are studying math and science. And I was like, but what about art and drama and liberal arts? And they were like, no, you don't get jobs with that. So both my sister and I basically studied science. And I think that was helpful to be in that sort of protective environment in those years. And in some way that shaped me that when you go off to college, you're just a lot, yeah, more confident.
Got it. And just maybe picking up on what you said, given you have children around that sort of stage, do you think about it any differently, boarding school versus day school?
Yeah. Well, so I married someone who didn't go to boarding school. So I think what happens in that battle is the one who didn't go to boarding school usually wins. Because you don't really want to send your kids away. I mean, I think they're very fulfilling to be together. I don't think it's an easy decision. And so, yeah, I didn't fight that battle.
And moving forward, clearly you had a really pedigreed background, right? Harvard, Morgan Stanley, UBS, some of the marquee names on your CV. Talk to us about how did Dasra happen at that inflection point, given the opportunity cost with an HBS MBA and some of these banks where you'd worked?
So, you know, for me, the biggest aspiration was to get a job. I know that sounds really kind of silly and basic. And then coming out of college, I came out in like one of the hottest years in Wall Street. So it really had nothing to do with me per se. But it had that they were like looking for young people into analyst programs at that time. And I had studied math. So I was like, oh, okay, let me sort of try Wall Street out. And I think that's, for me, became an eye-opener where I went to New York. I was in, you know, mergers and acquisitions. And I think that started down this path of what one imagines one could never be a part of. But then all of a sudden you're there and you're like, really, this isn't that big of a deal. So I think once you achieve what you imagine, sometimes it loses its charm, for lack of a better word. And so I was down this path, but I was still, you know, on that path, or what people usually do. So you go to Morgan Stanley, then after Morgan Stanley, you go to private equity funds or you go to business school. I was like, well, I'll go to a private equity fund. And if I don't get into business school, I don't really want to go to business school. So I was like, but if I do want to go to business school, then I'll really only want to go to Harvard, and I'll probably never get in anyway. So I only applied to HBS. And then I got in and I was like, oh, geez, I got in. I better go. Kind of felt like maybe they made a mistake. So I better not, no one should catch on, and then I'll just kind of go. But I think there were a few years at Morgan Stanley, which is actually where I met Deval, my husband. And we both sort of run, not sort of, we both run Dasra together. He was an analyst at Morgan Stanley in the leveraged buyout group, and I was an analyst in M&A. And I think when you're young and you're working 100, sometimes 120 hours a week, you have these sort of contemplative moments about why is it that we're making these PowerPoints and Excel spreadsheets, and really, are we having an impact by these kinds of things you read in the big deals you read in the newspaper? And I think that's really where we seeded some of our dreams about what Thusra might end up being. But frankly, I actually never had the courage. And Deval has a tremendous sense of idealism and altruistic. And so I was like, you go and do this Thusra thing. I've gotten into business school, so I'm going to business school. And I think for me, after getting to HBS, it was a combination of realizing that, wait a second, am I really making a difference? And the school kind of brainwashes you. You know, their whole thing is leaders that make a difference in the world. And so after having Morgan Stanley, after having sort of Harvard Business School, I think you realize, or at least I realized, I came from privilege, not from wealth, but privilege of whether it's education or exposure, that all of a sudden you start to wonder, like, can you use that to actually make a difference? By then, Deval had already started Thusra, and I was like, wow, that looks like fun. I still didn't have the courage, so I went back to UBS, because I also had loans from school. And then about a year into UBS, I was like, oh, okay, I think I'm ready. What do I have to lose, kind of?
Yeah, the other question I had was about sort of the ROI on the MBA, the sort of paying off the debt and stuff. So I guess you sort of joined UBS, paid that off, and then I guess...
So I joined UBS. I didn't pay it all off because I had big loans. I also went to school and thoroughly enjoyed school. So it wasn't like I lived on a really small budget or anything like I should have in retrospect. But I was part of the school's loan forgiveness program when you move into doing social enterprise work. So I was the longest, I think I still am the longest standing in the history of school to have made as little as I have or had. For 12 years, I was on that program. It's like a mortgage, so you keep kind of paying and the school kind of helps you through. I remember getting permission from Dean Noria to extend the 10 years to the 12 years. So yeah, I was on the loan forgiveness program. I didn't actually think about my HBS degree as like an asset that I could market. I just took it as a development opportunity, a learning opportunity. And now I realize years later how it does help and it can be leveraged from both the institution and what it represents. And that what I'm most excited about now is being able to extend everything the school is potentially about and the learning to the social sector. And so over the years, I've started to feel very proud of the fact that you can have this kind of background, but you can kind of move out, for lack of a better word, and bridge to the social sector. And I think more and more people are starting to walk that bridge. And I think that bridge is not as shaky as it used to be, even in my time and in the years that, you know, I made the transition.
Mm-hmm. And what's changed? Maybe just picking up on the bridge not being as shaky as it was in the past.
I think as a society, people think it's cooler. So, you know, you're not a loser if you're in the social sector. So some of the social image and social pressures, I think, have definitely moved. I think the millennial generation, for sure, just realizing that they want to make a difference and that's important to them. I think some of that shift has been important. So, and I think that whether it's the private sector or the public sector, I think recognizes a need for leadership and talent to move into this sector of civil society because of the extent of the problems that we have are not going to go away if we don't really sort of tackle it.
Got it. So let's move to Thusra, Anita. In cutting to the present, I understand you focus on three pillars of impact. One's research, second is building organizations, and third is about giving strategically. Talk to us a little bit about how you got here. And the reason I ask is a lot of people have sort of this 30,000 feet view of I want to make a difference, but it takes a while for them to figure out what's the way in which they can make a difference. So talk to us a little bit about the journey and how you got here.
Oh, it's a good question. So I actually romanticized about being in the field, and I I am and was always motivated by sort of rural women and women's empowerment and how much of the family unit depends on sort of their strength and everything that they do. And I was like, I want to be able to mobilize women in the community. And that's actually when in my summer at HBS, I went to SEVA. And so with a finance background, microfinance was actually very hot at that time. It had just started to pick up, and I had read this book by David Bornstein called Price of a Dream, and it was like all about how microfinance and access to finance was empowering for women, and these self-help groups was really, you know, strengthening their agency in the communities. And I was like, I want to be a part of that. And so I went to SEVA, and SEVA was like, okay, fine, you know, come hang out with us. We're trying to create a pension product for these women. And I think while I was in the field, for lack of a better word, I think it occurred to me that, you know what, there are people who are much better at mobilizing communities. A, I wasn't from here. B, I have an accent. It's not like my Hindi's that great. Really, was I using my skills well? And there were people who were far better at bringing these communities and really helping educate these women on sort of what's needed. And I think that's where I took a step back and I thought to myself, what are the skills that I actually have? And although I may not be so close to the lives that we're trying to change, is there a role to play as in between of sorts? And having been on the side of, you know, on the side of where there is the private sector and kinds of people who don't understand what's actually happening or the challenges on the ground, I found myself starting to be that bridge, actually. So more between these two, being able to speak the language of, you know, the funder, and on the other hand, also be able to relate and understand more to the NGOs than to the communities. And so long story short, we realized that what could really potentially have an impact was, can we strengthen the NGOs themselves that are working with the community?
And this was, the SEVA experience was in parallel with Deval starting?
Yes, having already started Dusra, actually, yeah.
Okay.
So I spent time both here with Dusra as well as with SEVA. So I split my summer into two. And when we started, we did a lot more of their venture philanthropy had just started to emerge. So basically it was taking venture capital and applying the same principles, but with philanthropy. So we started with earlier stage organizations like Magic Bus when it had just started, Anjali, a mental health program, Akshay Patra, which is now a big midday meal program. When these were very small emerging organizations, we started with them.
So you raised a fund and you deployed it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Almost like, I mean, the reason I mention is the last conversation I had was with Rupa Kudwa at Omidia Network.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I guess they're one of those people that sort of do a combination of writing checks to NGOs and investing.
Yes.
So you sort of almost set up a fund.
So we set up a fund, but it was only to give grants.
Okay.
It was not to do equity investing or debt or actually do any investing.
Sure.
But it was early stage nonprofits. So NGOs were just starting, and we realized very quickly that if you're too early in that stage, it's a lot of, not drain, but there's a lot to do with these organizations. That Dusra as an organization couldn't help that many NGOs in our portfolio if we were going to be that early stage. But we started with the whole premise of, if we can support nonprofits to scale, then their impact will scale and then will potentially solve problems. And we came from an angle of, you know, can we build management capacity? So how do you build institutions? How do you have them think about business management kind of stuff? Because ultimately, if you strengthen that, then their programs will also strengthen, and that there wasn't enough investment in building organizations. And that the funding out there was typically just going to program rather than really investing in people and systems and things that make the corporate sector flourish are similar to what's needed in the nonprofit sector. We felt that we should place ourselves there and make a case for how that ultimately scales impact. And so we started with the premise of, how do you help NGOs grow? But then to help NGOs grow, you have to influence the funding because it costs money. And if the funding's only really wanting to go to program, we needed to start to educate funders on how this actually makes more of a difference and can be transformational in terms of scale for these organizations. And that's really where our work around influencing philanthropy started. And to influence philanthropy, it needs to be research-based, so that you can help them understand where's the gap, what's the sector. And for us to start to really connect with, see, there's all this research out there, but what's actually happening on the ground, right? What are the interventions and what are the NGOs actually doing is what our research really tries to do, is look at what's the reality of what's happening, what does research, secondary research actually say, where is that gap, and therefore where can philanthropy make a difference?
Got it. And given these three pillars, how do you think about success at DSRA? What are the metrics that you sort of track at, let's say, at a dashboard level?
I mean, one very obvious one is how much money do we raise? Another one is how many organizations do we support and what's the growth of those organizations, typically looking at team size and budget. You know, but now we're also at a place after 18 years asking ourselves, great, so these are output numbers, right? But ultimately, are we changing lives? And I think it's a difficult question to answer. And it's not, the sector's not set up to easily answer that. And so what our next phase for DSRA is, how do we hold ourselves more accountable to, like, are we prioritizing lives? Are lives even changing with what we're trying to do? And that's going to require us to change, again, how funders work and how NGOs work.
And give me an example just to make illustrate the point. What do you mean by changing lives? Measuring changing lives?
So outcomes, right? Are kids actually learning in school? Are we really improving nutrition? Are we delaying the age of marriage for young girls? So there are certain outcomes that all of these activities and everything is ultimately trying to address, but are we really moving on that? And I think as a world, we're trying to hold ourselves accountable to the Sustainable Development Goals. But if you really look at those goals and you see what's happening on the ground, we're not really measuring any movement on those goals. And a country like India, where we have the highest prevalence of probably everything, if you move the needle in India, you move the needle globally on the Sustainable Development Goals. And we have to be able to start to measure that. And part of measurement will allow us to also think about what's working, what's not working. So having this kind of learning feedback loops, those systems don't exist with these organizations because funders often don't fund it and that capability doesn't exist. And so I think the sector is becoming more sophisticated and complex. And so I think it is important for us to think about how we measure our impact. And that's what I mean, like impact on lives.
Got it.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman here. What Neera says about DSRA as an organization, figuring out the key axes of impact, is as relevant for individual leaders making choices during key transitions. One of my earlier guests, Rupa Kudwa of a media network, spoke about how she thought about this when she decided to move on from Crisil to do something else.
Because in Crisil, you know, I was just fortunate to have a set of clients who were all either policymakers or regulators or CEOs of companies, and I had the platform to interact with them, and everyone knew that I was going to leave, and so they all called up and said, let's chat, etc. And so I would go and have a cup of tea with, and I did this with about 45 people, I think, and over the 9 months, and it was just amazing, as my friend had told me, the insights that I got. And I think the first clarity that I got was on what I did not want to do. And I think that itself became clear to me through these conversations, and as people said, why don't you do this? Or we think, why don't you join us? And that gave me the clarity on what I did that helped in the elimination process. In my mind, I don't want to do this.
I guess it's key to note that there's a spread of options that are available to people that want to make a difference. Impact investing, impact investment banking, impact research, leadership development, building a platform, or creating an organization. And I'm sure there's more. The key is to give yourself the time to discover the product market fit, if I may use the term, and then ensure that you transition thoughtfully, then jump into the first option that comes your way. A quick note on the podcast. If you wish to access more content, you could visit playtopotential.com, where you could either listen to a leader's reflections from their journey or get perspectives from multiple leaders on one topic, say reinventing yourself, where people talk about how they move from one trajectory to another. you could visit the curated playlist section at playtopotential.com to explore this feature. If you want to listen offline, you could download this podcast on most of the podcast apps that are out there on the Android and the Apple platforms. If you find this content purposeful, do leave a review on iTunes. That would be helpful in getting more people to access this content and benefit from it. Now, back to the conversation with Neera.
Just picking up on the fact that you run it with your Deval, your spouse.
Yeah.
I'm also curious about two leaders who are married who run a company. Again, for people who are in a similar sort of a boat, any lessons you've learned over the last 18 plus years of things to watch out for as people embark on a journey?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's good days and bad days. To be honest, and today is a good day, so I feel like it's, I think it's a real privilege and opportunity to be able to share something and do it together. But I think with that comes the complexity of just work being everywhere all the time. I think what's held us together is ultimately the impact that we're trying to have, and I think an appreciation and respect for what my skills and strengths might be and what Deval's skills and strengths are. And if you folks who might know us or not know us, we're quite different in how we work and how we think. And so I think it's the recognition of these differences coming together ultimately can have more of an impact. And it's about compromise, whether in the workplace or in your personal life. It has a lot to do with compromise. But I think if you're ultimately keeping the impact at the forefront, like, are we really making a difference? Is this where, Dusra should be going? And this is the impact we want to have. I think we almost always align on that. I think we always align on the what. It's the how that often gets some of the conflict. And so I think separating some of the you do this and I'll do this kind of thing.
And how have you thought about role separation over the years? Has there been a sort of, again, with the wisdom of hindsight, would you have done anything differently in terms of how you've carved out your respective roles as Dusra grew?
I think I wish we were more deliberate about it. And, as entrepreneurs and founders, you just kind of like always on the go, right? You're never kind of thinking, oh, I wonder what, your role should be and my role should be. It's like, well, today we're firefighting, so do what you need to do. If I reflect back and, even going forward, I'm much more of like a structured, I try to be a structured person. I manage the teams more and the workflow more. And Deval's a rock star at sales, for lack of selling. Like a real believer in like what we're doing and can be very inspiring and motivating. And he feels happy talking. He could convince like a deadbeat brick that Dusra has something to do. Whereas for me, if I have even the slightest signal that the person I'm speaking to is actually not interested, I don't even want to speak to them. So I think we've separated to the extent that he really pushes kind of the external piece and working with philanthropists and taking them actually on that journey with his team. And I'm much more on the side of sort of the research and the due diligence and working with organizations and now taking more of a sector view. So I'm much more thinking about how do we move sectors rather than nonprofits. So you can work with nonprofits, but ultimately a portfolio approach and, thinking about what do adolescent girls need or urban sanitation. And we're also in democracy and governance as sectors is where I have ended up placing myself, I guess.
Got it. More of a systemic response to a problem rather than episodic by working with a few organizations.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, we've both had, every so often I'll have my outburst of like, why do you get all the glory and nobody even knows who I am and blah, blah, blah. And then he'd be like, well, I'm not stopping you. I was like, that's a good point.
Speaking up on the theme of ambition, Neera, talk to us about how your ambition for Dusra has evolved over time. What was it 18 years back? What is it today? And how has it evolved?
So there's something about ambition that somehow I relate to ego. So I don't entirely resonate with the word, but maybe aspiration or feels a bit better. So to be very honest, I was probably very young and naive, and I was like, I have nothing to lose. I have everything to learn from joining and being part of what we imagined Dasra to be. But we didn't actually imagine in the long term. I think it was, let's help a few NGOs. Then we were like, wait a second, we're helping a few NGOs. Now we should be working with funders. And I think it was only 5 or 6 years ago, because the first 10 years was bumpy. Like, we were living hand to mouth, for lack of a better word. And just trying to figure out, like, what's our model? How is this going to be sustainable? And, you know, are we going to be able to hire people? And it was about 5 or 6 years ago where actually every year we had saved money. And we had a point in time where we lost all of our funding and we had to let go of our team, that it made us very nervous about growing again. And so not only were we growing our family at the time, we were also questioning, like, should we be growing Dasra, and should it just be kind of Devil and I doing this boutique kind of thing? And we told ourselves when we had lost all of our money that going forward, we would always keep 2 years of cash. So whatever our team size would be, we'd always have 2 years of cash to be able to fund that particular team size, which is really conservative. So about 5 or 6 years ago, we had asked ourselves that, you know, did we really create Dasra to be a tiny little shop? And if we see the potential for the impact to be bigger than ourselves, then why are we constraining this? And we have money to be able to invest in new opportunities or initiatives. I think that both of us said it's almost irresponsible to have created something just for us. And if we see more potential for impact ultimately on lives and solving some of these problems, then let's fund this opportunity, which we called the Indian Philanthropy Forum. Mm-hmm. And so we started at that point to realize there's wealth in India, there's new wealth in India, there's business leaders and people who also want to participate in the social sector. And that, can we be part of this indigenous giving kind of movement? Why don't we start to build that? And we had had conversations with Give India to do this together. And we thought to ourselves, well, you know, we should do it. And why don't we take money that we've saved and put it into this new initiative? And I think that's where we realized, now this is beyond the two of us. And it should be beyond the two of us. Now, should it last forever? No. But I think there's much more to be done. And therefore, thinking about how Dasra grows and the role that we play and how do we both transition to, you know, a larger, bigger One Dasra kind of organization, I think is where we are now.
And how do you think, just picking up on the point about transition, how do you think about the transition to the new phase? And I say that, and I ask that in two different ways, right? One is, I'm curious about your evolution as a leader.
Yeah.
As Dasra, the organization, has grown, you and Deval evolving as people, but also what's the sort of the next step from a governance standpoint for you to transition to the next orbit?
It's a good question. I want to be much more deliberate about the transition. And I feel often as founders, especially for nonprofits, we're very poor at transition. And so much of the organizations, whether it's energy or dynamism, ends up being very concentrated with the founder. And we're often very irresponsible, I think, about it. So I want to be much more deliberate about the transition. But it's hard because you don't know anything else, right? And so I had thought I would transition earlier. It was our board, and I actually had gotten very sick 2 years ago, to maybe now 3 years, 3 years ago. And I think when I got really sick, both of us were like, wait a second, this is, you know, why are we doing all of this? Should we really slow down? I was like, let me phase out. And then as I got healthier and healthier, I got more and more excited about what Dasra was all about and wanted to sort of re-engage. And so I think the personal phases of your life often will influence where you are sort of in your professional life. So I went through a phase of, is it the right time to transition now? I would have been 40. I was 40.
When you say transition to
less day-to-day responsibility, and not being on execution, not being so responsible for fundraising for the organization and leading some of where we're going. A lot of it rests still with us. And feeling like we really need to hire more. We've all gone through our phases of hiring leadership, but I think we don't think enough of like, so you hire this leadership, where's my role gonna go? And I think as I got healthier and wanted to re-engage with Dasra, the board, we had shared our transition thoughts or succession planning with the board. And our board came back to us, interestingly enough, and said, you're still young at 40. You still have, 10 years, if not more. Why wouldn't you still give this time to Dasra? Why would you think about transitioning now? And I thought to myself, that's a good point. but I do think between 5 to 8 years, one needs 5 to 8 years to really think about the succession. So I am thinking about it, coming much more off of day-to-day execution, decentralizing decision-making. There are a lot of things that one needs to start to have the organization be able to do without us there on one hand. And on the other hand, how do you build and continue the motivation and the passion and sort of what I love what Bain calls the founder's mentality? I feel that there is something to be said about building that kind of culture. And so as much as we're thinking about transition, I think we still are at a point, at least at Dasra, that we carry the culture. We still continue to influence what's, not negotiable here and what is this organization going to be like? And what are the kinds of people we want? Because we're still small. It's 120. And although it completely freaks me out sometimes, you look at other organizations that are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, gives you a bit of a reality check that, 120 is still small. So we're still like a family. But that being said, I do think transition is on the top of my mind, but transition to a potential role within Dasra partially, I wonder. But there's always a hangover, I do think, when founders just hang around. There's that aura, good and bad, that whoever you will bring or the group that will start to emerge as taking that leadership shouldn't be hindered by, our
the
presence.
Shadows.
Yeah. And so that's a bit of a long-term view. Right now, we're like in the midst of how do we decentralize? How do we hire leaders? And how do we build our culture?
Got it. I want to pick up on the work you do in the context of building leadership capacity in
yes.
not-for-profits. And again, given your personal journey in what you're building and your experience with working with several not-for-profits, what are the key pillars of leadership development you think about, which is specifically amplified in the social impact space?
So we run a leadership program,
right.
And that actually emerged after we ran what was called an accelerator program. So we started working with organizations and saying, wait, they need kind of help. The heads of these organizations needed help to how to think about their business plan and how to pitch. And that was sort of what we thought was the need. And then we realized, actually, it's the leadership itself that if you can influence that, it can be transformational for the organization. And so we realized then that it was building leadership in the context of business practices. So we run 4 modules. We have leadership and strategy. We have leadership and brand. We have leadership and talent. And then our last one is sort of leadership and legacy. And so bringing together the individual, but also in the context of the organization, and therefore how does their leadership play into the organization, is a lot of where we try and help the social sector leaders who don't actually get that kind of exposure. So we work really hard to translate a lot of sort of management business speak into how do you make it relevant for sort of the nonprofit leader is a lot easier than most realize. But there's a lot of lessons to be learned even from for. Ultimately, for-profits or non-profits, organizationally, I really believe you deal with the same challenges. It's just one has a model that can make money, and one has a model that's trying to have impact. So yeah, I mean, what have we focused on? We focused on leadership because we ultimately realized you get the most leverage there, and there isn't enough research around how do you really kind of strengthen and magnify that.
And let's say within that, if we double click on leadership as a theme, are there one or two things that you find, that people find hard to scale? When it comes to development, are there one or two areas that you see a lot of people struggling with or grappling with when it comes to expanding their own capacity?
So I think, and this is probably true of entrepreneurship, entrepreneurs and founders as well, is that you play many roles. And deconstructing those roles for, you know, ultimately to scale beyond that individual, I think is very difficult. And so these leaders don't always understand their strengths, A. B, they are in it for the impact, and often don't build systems that are sustainable beyond themselves. And so they're not thinking about paying themselves. And so then you're like, the top person's not paying themselves. So then what happens to salaries below? And they're thinking so much, they're so driven by the mission that they're not thinking organizationally what's going to happen, or how are we really going to grow our impact. I think is one part, being very mission driven and then therefore compromising sustainability of the organization. I think leaders don't understand in our sector, frankly, even in the for-profit sector, really what are their strengths and where should they be spending time. And therefore they often are all over the place. So they're fundraising, they're all the way in programs, and frankly, not great people managers. And I think where you reach that inflection point in the organization is where do you start to bring people in? And it's not about just growing people from within. There's often a conflict with these leaders around loyalty, commitment, and your organization often grows beyond the group of people that you started with. And somehow in the social sector, whether it's an ideology or a philosophy, it's making these kinds of difficult decisions often is hard for these leaders.
And talking about attracting talent, right? Clearly, you know, you want to have good people working with you, but there is a budget constraint as compared to the for-profit world. Are there any things that you've seen effective entrepreneurs and organizations do in addressing this sort of, not asymmetry, but sort of this distortion where you're seeking the best minds to work with you, but you're operating under a tight constraint? So what's been your observation of people that sort of work creatively around this?
So I believe people don't work for money. Ultimately, that is not their first driver, as in a salary. And so I think our sector actually is extremely motivating for folks, and many will come in for the impact, what they imagine the impact to be, and are motivated by the fact that they're participating in something, you know, impactful. And so you can often sell, for lack of a better word, sell the impact and how their job's going to be, you know, so different than being an analyst at an investment bank. And why not take that opportunity? And therefore, why not take the pay cut? So there's no doubt. I mean, almost everyone here at Dusra is earning way less than they would if they had gone, some of them had pursued their for-profit pathways. I mean, I look at my peers, they're making millions and millions. And so one is, I don't think people are motivated by some people are not motivated by money. I think understanding people's motivations and providing them the opportunity, people want to contribute ultimately, right? People want to feel valued by an organization. And I think in the social sector, you're connect to the kinds of communities you're trying to ultimately have an impact. If you can keep that connect alive as an organization, I think that's the second thing that's very attractive. And third, you know, ultimately it is about who they're working with and who they're working for. Sounds strong, but who you're working for, right? Like, do they care about you? Are they helping you learn and develop? You know, are they giving you exposure to things you never would have really gotten at your stage? And so I think these three things often, you know, people take the leap earlier in life. I think more and more people later in life are saying, okay, well, I'm an empty nest. I kind of have the money that I think I need for sort of security. Now I'm ready to go and kind of save the world. There's more and more folks that are doing that, but, you know, let me be honest, they're not easy to work with.
But going back to the first category where they still haven't really, you know, sorted out the financial commitments. They're still on that journey to sort of accumulating savings.
Yeah.
Is there anything to be said about how people marry a sense of purpose with a sense of pragmatism in terms of solving for the financial need? Is there any insight there?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it ultimately has to do with your own personal needs. I was reading this book, Ray Dalio's Principles.
Lovely book.
It's a really great book. And he has this such a basic thing in it that says something like having basic necessities like good relationships, you know, a comfortable bed, good food and good sex, you know, all of that doesn't get any better or any worse with more money or less money for most of us. You know, and I think that really depends from an individual perspective, what are you comfortable with? I mean, at least for me personally, what helped me make the transition, at least from investment banking, was I am not motivated by these big deals. So it is not exciting for me. So I'm almost thinking, well, it's kind of strange how excited you are. Like, really, are you making a difference? And so for me, it was more, I'll live in the money that I'll have, and, you know, I'll be motivated by the work that I'm doing. So I'll have to live within those constraints. And so when I meet young people and I'm interviewing them, right? And they're like, but my budget is this, or I won't be able to live in, you know, this kind of building or that kind of building. I'm like, build a budget and figure out whether you can live in that or not. And some people can and some people can't. So it's not good or bad. But I think it's being practical about what you need. And I think there's quite a lot of people who will live within certain limitations to have the fabulous opportunity of making a difference and doing something different and impactful. And it's not like we're poor in the sector. You know, we're still paying to be able to live comfortably. And I think the amazing thing about India is the amounts that people live on is, you know, phenomenal. That no one can tell me you can't live a comfortable life in the salary that Dasra is providing you. Now, it may not be the life that you've decided to have, which is fine, but it's not like, I mean, look at people
sort of
are
the needs
on,
and the wants, right?
Yes.
It's definitely solves the needs. The wants are infinite, right? I guess.
Right. So. And then once you get what you wanted, then you were like, wait a second, I'm not entirely fulfilled anyway. So, but it's a journey for everyone. So, I think some people, you know, have an epiphany and some people have to go through that journey. You know, I need more people to do it quicker. So.
But back to the second cluster, people that sort of are further along their life, they've taken care of the savings and they're empty nesters, to use your word. What are some of the observations you have around how they transition and what are some of the mistakes they make in transitioning? What they think it is and what it is sometimes is different. So what's been your observation about that transition?
I think now I'm realizing the most difficult part of the transition is most of us at the stage we're in our organizations, at least in the social sector, we need people who roll up their sleeves. Function in ambiguity. We don't have structures and systems similar to a corporate sector. We need shapers. But we need shapers and doers, right? And when you come at that stage in your life, you have been in a career where you are like an orchestrator, right? You're like, you do this, and you kind of oversee. I mean, the pace is different. The talent is different. The resources are super constrained. So you're working in a very different environment. Now, some will thrive in it, but a lot have to just change their mindset to what it's going to take for them to really leverage their skills. And I think that's the challenge, is that they have grown in their corporate, you know, trajectory. And then you come into the social sector and the environment and the construct, I think, is a real challenge. And some will thrive in it. I think it depends where you come from and the kinds of backgrounds. But it's kind of like, you know, HBS talks about this. You can have stars in certain environments that when you hire those stars are actually not that great performers in your existing environment. And so that's similar. I think you have to get back to the basics of like attitude, behaviors, values, and all of that, I feel, is much more important than like some of the harder skills.
The skills.
Yeah.
But again, the other piece I'm curious about this particular transition, Neera, is also sort of the mode of impact they choose. You know, like you sort of eventually came to these three pillars for Dasra. Do you see sort of systematic mistakes people make? Or do you have observations around what sometimes they get wrong when they transition from for-profit to the world of social impact?
So you can transition to the world of social impact, right, in two ways, especially later in life. With your wealth, to be an actual philanthropist and to be giving, and to actually be like an employee and a staff person of a nonprofit.
It's time or money, right?
Right, yeah. Time or money. And I think what happens later in life is whether it's your ego or your position, you all of a sudden think like you know everything, and maybe you did where you were, but the game's different in this sector. So often we struggle with humility, we struggle with listening, we struggle with, you know, you've not done this before. So I think they bring a real great sense of lived experience, but sometimes there's this strange power imbalance that often happens where they feel they're coming from privilege, either with money or time. And somehow all of us sitting in the social sector are like desperate for all of this. But it takes us time and to figure out how to leverage these kinds of individuals, whether it's time or money. And because, you know, we're even resource constrained when it's with money, you're often sometimes even compromising where your strategy is or the things you're going to do because you're trying to kind of get funding. So there's a bit of a dance, I think, that takes place. And so being a bit more patient, I think the pace, you know, although the pace and the complexity of what we do is different than the corporate sector, that's where I find some of these challenges with the later stage players.
Just talking about the leadership in the social impact space, Neera, again, when you look at the spectrum of leaders in this space, and when you look at the people that have driven large-scale impact, what about them stands out? What about these leaders stands out? And if there's any nuance around how they're different from the leaders that we see in the corporate world?
I think what has really helped leaders be successful in our sector, what I mean by successful is having scaled their impact, is I think they are great storytellers. I think they are able to help and influence folks on, like, what's the narrative whether in their sectors that they're in. And so with that, they're able to really influence and engage people, whether it's funding, whether it's hiring people. So I think it's one part is that they're really actually good with storytelling and being convincing that there's a need to participate in whatever it is that they're building. I think that passion and sometimes a real sort of aggressive mission, being very mission-driven, can be inspiring. So they're very inspiring people by their sometimes being very dogmatic and almost overly passionate about what they're trying to solve. I think that that is really important. And their inherent desire from the very beginning to scale. When you meet some leaders who are maybe kind of like we were, incremental, you know, just kind of going day to day when we kind of first started, you're not going to reach that transformational scale that we need these organizations to get to, right, to solve the problem. The leaders that we've seen, you know, be successful have thought about it from the very beginning, wanting to have, you know, really impact millions. I think the other thing is that they are and identify with the community ultimately that they're trying to help and really feel for the empathy with
what these vulnerable communities are going through. And then maybe that's connected to the first one. They're able to share that story. So very strong communicators, let's say. Very strong communicators, very high energy, you know, like the fast pace, can meet different kinds of people, manage complexity, I think, really well. But yeah, still very strong personalities, I believe, yeah.
And given that sort of there's a new opportunity with tech to drive impact at scale, yeah. Do you see a different breed of leaders emerging from that sort of space?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our sector has gone from seeing leaders of seva like Ila to, you know, leadership that are running tech companies that come, you know, from an MBA from Harvard Business School. So you have the whole range of leadership. And it's interesting to see these newer age, let's call them, the newer age social entrepreneurs are impatient, right? And they want growth and they are pushing for it. And there's also funding that's, you know, also enticed by it. I think technology is an enabler. But you need both to coexist. And I think we shouldn't discount, obviously nobody discounts Ila from Seva, but you can't discount the activist. You can't discount people who are mobilizing communities because that takes time. And so you need different kinds of models to coexist for ultimately the scale and impact that we're having. And so each of these models, just like in business, will have a scale trajectory, right? And some things will take longer, and community mobilization is a lot more expensive and it takes, you know, a lot more time. Technology is way cheaper. You get outreach very quickly. And so each of them play their role. And I think we don't do enough of that in our sector, which is understand the business model. So this whole for-profit, non-profit conversation, or this impact investing, like, why can't we solve the world's problems with equity and debt? I mean, really? There's a need for subsidized models because there's customers who will not be able to pay for the services and products that are being provided. That's because the government has failed, right, to some extent. So all of us MBAers or for-profit people who think you're going to solve all of this with a for-profit model, you know, it's mistaken. We don't have markets. People are living on $2 a day. They don't have money to pay for these kinds, for basic needs, that understanding which models can have equity and debt because you have revenue, right? And you have a margin. And which are you nonprofit because there isn't an ability for the ultimate beneficiary to pay for those services. And therefore, that needs to be subsidized either with government money or with grant money. And in other places, you're building a market. And so whoever's building that last mile actually needs potentially a subsidized model. So we don't deconstruct these enough to understand with this kind of model, this is the kind of scale one will get. This is the kind of financing you actually need. And so some of this stuff that potentially seems obvious to all of us, I don't think we apply enough actually to the sector.
Very interesting. I guess in some ways you're saying the private sector can't be, if it's solving public sector problems, then it can't be on a for-profit basis, right? Something has to give.
Exactly.
For you to be solving public problems, which the public sector is supposed to solve or the government is supposed to solve. A fair insight. I think this is fantastic, Neera. Just wrapping up, this podcast is titled Play to Potential. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I do believe the two questions people grapple with as they go through their journey is where to go and how to grow. Mm-hmm. Making choices, navigational choices at different points in time, and also having made a choice going up the curve. In summary, given your journey, what are your thoughts in summary around people to play to their unique potential?
I mean, I think the most important thing is it's not about yourself. It's about how do you bring others to magnify your individual potential. And so I actually think it's less about individual. It's more about how are you playing to your potential by bringing others along with what you're trying to achieve or the difference you're trying to make. I think take signals. I don't think playing to one's potential is a lone journey. It's all about bringing people along with you. And I think building relationships, because it's that energy, it's those signals, it's that advice that ultimately opens up your own eyes of what you can see yourself being able to contribute to.
And when you say take signals, just to maybe understand what you have in mind when you say that.
I think people will say what you do well. People will say what you don't do well. Often people give you unsolicited advice. You know, you get cues from folks. And I think one should be listening to that. And often you subconsciously don't realize that either that affirmation or defamation is building who you are and building your potential. And so I think being much more authentic about recognizing all of that and bringing it together to actually have the courage. I think a lot of playing to your potential has to do with courage, and you don't jump out alone, right? And so if you bring others with you, you'll kind of have a parachute.
Lovely. A pleasure talking to you, Neera. Thank you so much for your time and insight.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Lovely. Thank you.
I hope you found the conversation as purposeful as I did. Take cues and signals from the world around you is such a simple but profound advice. When I work with leaders in transition, the first piece is often about getting feedback from the world around them on what people think about the ideal canvas in which they are likely to flourish. And the challenge is, in our workplaces, we get feedback around our strengths and weaknesses in the context of our current canvas. And that's the how to grow question. But the where to go question is often framed as, what's the ideal, if I gave you a blank sheet of paper, what's the ideal canvas where you'll bring your best to offer? If this piece is of interest, you might want to tune into the conversation with Anu Madgaonkar of McKinsey, who talks about how she moved from banking to consulting to research, or the conversation with Rupa Kudwa, who talks about how she moved from Crisil to Amudia Network, or the conversation with Atul Kasbekar, who talked about how he moved from being a photographer to producing movies. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Signing off, this is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. To know more about the work I do, please visit transitioninsight.com. Bye now.